This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
At least three rockets hit a military base at Iraqi capital's international airport, which houses U.S. troops. Syria calls on the UN to condemn Israel's repeated acts of aggression against its sovereignty. And activists slam U.S. police brutality and racial profiling during a funeral for a black man killed by a white cop in Minnesota. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in for World News. Our top story, Iraqi security officials say that at least three rockets have landed in the perimeter of the Baghdad International Airport. Officials said rockets struck near an area of the airport which houses U.S. forces. No damage or casualties have been reported. There's been no immediate claim either of responsibility as of yet. On Sunday, five rockets targeted an Iraqi airbase located north of Baghdad, which also hosts U.S. soldiers and warplanes. U.S.-led facilities, forces, and supply convoys in Iraq have repeatedly been targeted in recent months. Anti-American sentiments are running high in the Arab country after the assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January last year. The Iraqi parliament then voted for the withdrawal of all American troops from the country. Author and Middle East affairs expert Kevin Barrett says, under international law, the Iraqi people have every right to resort to force to remove the occupation.
Well, the Iraqi people have every right to do this because under international law, occupation is illegal, and the occupied peoples have the right to use force to remove the occupation. This is a basic tenet of international law. And so every minute that the United States remains occupying Iraq, which it occupied in a war of aggression, which is the supreme war crime under the Nuremberg precedents, meaning every American that took part in this war in Iraq deserves to be executed for the worst war crime there is. It's worse than genocide. According to Nuremberg, the worst crime that Germany committed during World War II was launching a war of aggression. And that precedent held up until the false flag events of September 2001. Since then, the United States has launched several totally unprovoked wars of aggression, including the war against Iraq, based on the false pretenses of so-called weapons of mass destruction that didn't even exist. The Iraqi people have heroically resisted this invasion and occupation, and indeed genocide. There's the book Genocide in Iraq that details how the U.S. invasion of Iraq has actually met the definition of genocide under international law. So the Iraqi people have been resisting from the very day that the Americans first landed, and they're continuing to resist now, and they're ramping up their resistance, and they are right under international law, and the Americans are wrong.
At least seven people are injured as Israeli forces attacked Palestinian protesters in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Clashes erupted near the Old City where Palestinians were protesting an Israeli ban on their access to a promenade where they usually get together after breaking their fast during the Muslim month of Ramadan. The latest scuffles came after videos posted online showed Palestinians being harassed Wednesday night by Jewish youths shouting death to Arabs. Syria condemns the latest Israeli missile attacks on its territory, describing them as a clear violation of the 1974 agreement on disengagement. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the United Nations to condemn the move and repeated violations of the nation's sovereignty. Ministry urged UN General Secretariat and Security Council to assume their responsibilities under the UN Charter in maintaining international peace and security. The reaction came after the Israeli regime carried out missile strikes near the Syrian capital, Damascus. Israel has repeatedly carried out strikes against Syria over recent years.
On Tuesday, a powerful explosion rocked a sensitive military factory in central Israel. The blast near the town of Raml sent up a massive plume of fire and smoke, which could be seen from miles away. Israeli sources said the incident happened during a routine test and caused no casualties. Less than 48 hours later, Israel again found itself under threat. The regime said a Syrian surface-to-air missile had exploded near the Dimona nuclear plant. Tel Aviv said the Syrian missile was fired toward one of its aircraft over the Golan Heights, but it overflew its target and landed in Israel. Following the explosion, Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, admitted that the regime's missile system failed to intercept the anti-aircraft missile. Gantz said an investigation has been launched into the failure of the so-called Iron Dome at stopping the projectile. Commentators believe that the incident further highlighted Israel's vulnerability.
This shows how Dimona, which is actually one of the most sensitive spots of the occupied territories, is vulnerable. Defense system, either Iron Dome or either any other defense system of the Zionist regime, have been booked there, and they were actually infiltrated by these rockets that were fired from the Syrian side.
U.S. media reports said the incident points to a possible Iranian involvement. Israeli media also said that anti-missile system around Dimona plant had been on high alert following the act of sabotage at Iran's Natanz nuclear facility earlier this month. However, Iran has not yet commented on the recent events. The incidents come at a time when Israel continues with its belligerent policies in the region. Tel Aviv has conducted hundreds of airstrikes on Syria over the past years. The regime has also been violating Lebanon's airspace on an almost daily basis. Despite all this, the regime has met little international backlash. Syria and Lebanon have time and again called on the international community to hold Tel Aviv to account, but to no avail. Israel has never disclosed its nuclear arsenal, and it does not allow international inspections of its nuclear sites. But the regime's possession of nuclear weapons is an open secret. In 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said Tel Aviv was in possession of at least 150 nuclear warheads.
The United States has more than 12,000 nuclear weapons, and the Soviet Union has about the same. And as you know, Great Britain and France have several hundred, and Israel has 150 or more.
With warmongers ruling in Tel Aviv taking provocative actions on a near daily basis, the region resembles a tinderbox. Following the recent incidents, the regime now has good reasons to think twice that any escalation and miscalculation could turn into an open confrontation in the region.
6 years of war on Yemen has had a devastating impact on the health sector of the country. Kidney patients are among those affected in Yemen amid a closure of many dialysis centers due to lack of fuel and medicine. Our correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washali has more.
A fight for survival is what kidney failure patients in Yemen face as a result of the ongoing war and siege by the Saudi-led coalition. Many dialysis centers had to stop providing services due to a lack of fuel and necessary medical equipment. Therefore, the only dialysis center in Hodeidah in western Yemen struggles to cope with the large number of patients.
The center provides health services to approximately 470 patients per week, and the number is likely to increase as we receive patients from other cities, and this exceeds the capacity of our center. So we may have to decrease the number of sessions allocated to each patient. We also suffer from a shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the continued Saudi blockade in our country.
Patients say lack of fuel worsens their suffering as they come from far areas twice a week and they can't afford the rising cost of transportation. Salim is one of them. He says he takes hours to get to the center due to the military confrontations on the main roads.
I live in an area half an hour away from the center, but the main road is closed due to the continuing military confrontations. So we have to take another road. It takes 2 hours. High fuel prices are also a major problem for us. We cannot afford the rising transportation costs.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to return the former president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. The brutal aggression has killed over 100,000 of civilians, most of them women and children. Hundreds of kidney failure patients may lose their lives if this center stops providing its services. However, as the people here say, the international community remains silent towards their sufferings. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Hudaydah.
A U.S. State Department official says that Washington will not remove all sanctions on Tehran amid negotiations between Iran and the P4 plus one group of countries to try to revive the 2015 nuclear deal.
What I will say, and as I said last time, but this time we have gone into more detail, is that we have provided Iran with a number of examples of the kind of sanctions that we believe we would need to lift in order to come back into compliance, and the sanctions that we believe we would not need to lift and we would not lift as part of a return into compliance with the JCPOA. And then a third category, which are the difficult cases because this is a complex process, but also because the Trump administration deliberately and avowedly imposed sanctions by invoking labels, terrorism labels and other labels, even though it was done purely for the purpose of preventing or hindering a return to the compliance with the JCPOA. So that has made it more difficult. We have to go through every sanction to make sure whether to look at whether they were legitimately or not legitimately imposed.
A senior official said there is no written guarantee a future U.S. administration will not abandon the deal, and that this has been made clear to Tehran. The official said there are still pretty important disagreements regarding what is required for a return to full compliance with the agreement. Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal, known as the JCPOA, have so far held three rounds of negotiations to revive the agreement. Now hundreds attend the funeral of African-American Dante Wright, who was fatally shot by a white policewoman in the U.S. state of Minnesota. Top state politicians and relatives of George Floyd, another black man killed by Minnesota police, attended the service. The 20-year-old Wright was laid to rest following a public viewing of his casket. Civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton made a speech at the funeral, slamming what he called the stench of racism in America.
When we come today as the air fresheners for Minnesota, we're trying to get the stench of police brutality out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racism out of the atmosphere. We're trying to get the stench of racial profiling out of the atmosphere. We come to Minnesota as air fresheners because your air is too odorous for us to breathe. We can't breathe in your stinking air no more.
Sharpton said police must understand they are not above the law. Wright was shot at a traffic stop in the Brooklyn Center on April 11th. Police said the officer mistook her handgun for a taser. The black man's death is one in a growing list of instances where African Americans are being killed at the hands of white police officers. The death of Floyd in Minneapolis in May of last year sparked a wave of protests against police brutality and racial profiling in the U.S. The U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly approved a bill aimed at combating violence against Asian communities in the country amid the COVID pandemic. Legislation was passed 94-1. Republican Senator Josh Hawley was the only vote against it. It's the first legislative measure by Congress to boost law enforcement's response to increasing attacks on people of Asian descent. The bill will create a Justice Department position focusing on the issue and beef up state and local hate crime reporting. It now goes to the House of Representatives before being signed into law by the President Joe Biden. The shooting of six Asian women in Atlanta in March focused attention on this issue. Attacks targeting Asian Americans, especially women or older people, increased by nearly 150% over the past year. The Russian defense minister says that he has ordered troops participating in military drills in the Crimea region to return to their bases Friday. Sergei Shoigu said that Russian troops demonstrated their ability to ensure reliable protection of the country. The military exercises, which involve tens of thousands of troops and dozens of warships and aircraft, have raised tensions between Moscow and Kiev along with its Western supporters. Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky welcomed the end of the war game, saying it could lead to reduced tensions exacerbated along the two countries' borders in recent weeks. NATO also said Russia's troop drawdown from areas near the Ukraine border is important and timely, but the alliance will remain vigilant. EU lawmakers say it's not good enough that just 8% of EU citizens have been fully vaccinated against the COVID-19. This as lockdowns across the 27-country bloc are having a major economic impact. Jerome Hughes reports.
The weather has been improving in the EU as we edge closer to summer, but airports remain virtually empty and the bloc's tourism sector is on its knees. EU legislators say there is no coordination.
Some member states asking 7 days of quarantine, some five, some requesting a type of test, some not. Greece taking away quarantine and so on and so on and so on.
Conflicting vaccination strategies are adding to the confusion for citizens.
There are restrictions in various member states, and maybe in terms of age or gender, are some states not using AstraZeneca at all, and I fear that that may be reflected as well in the Johnson & Johnson availability.
The European Commission has set a target to see two-thirds of EU citizens vaccinated by the 1st of September, but things aren't going well.
Only 8% have both inoculations needed. What is being done to reach the 70% target in the next 4 months?
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides prefers to talk about vaccines ordered rather than vaccines administered.
About 300 million doses of vaccines.
When signing new contracts with suppliers, EU lawmakers are calling for less secrecy.
Please also make sure that this time the contracts can be available. The Commission is always saying we want it, but we can't because of the companies. Make sure you're not bound by it in the next contract.
Slow vaccination rollout means new variants might emerge. Also, millions of businesses must remain closed. The European Trade Union Confederation warns youth unemployment in the EU is set to rise by 70%, that's 70, unless drastic measures are taken by governments and institutions. The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, is painting a gloomy picture.
The near-term economic outlook remains clouded by uncertainty about the resurgence of the pandemic and the rollout of vaccination campaigns.
In the EU, people out of work for more than 12 months are classified as long-term unemployed.
A crisis this deep has generated a huge number of long-term unemployed, and that may be a problem as the economy picks up.
Lawmakers and the European Central Bank are calling on EU leaders to speed up the delivery of financial support. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. It is narrated from Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, that he said to Jabir, son of Abdullah Ansari, O Jabir, this month is Ramadan. He who fasts its day, stands for prayer in part of its night, prevents his stomach and private part from haram, and keeps his tongue from saying anything sinful, will go out of his sins like going out of the month of Ramadan. Jobber said, O God's messenger, how good the hadith is. The prophet said, O Jobber, how hard are the conditions that I said. Imam Reza, peace upon him, also said, Small sins are the ground for great sins. Anyone who doesn't fear God in a small sin will not fear him in a great one either. It means if a person commits a minor sin and considers it unimportant, this will cause him to repeat the sin, and this will be considered as a great sin by God. The blessed month of Ramadan is the best opportunity to practice refraining from sins and getting accustomed to saying no to the Satan and carnal desires. According to the Islamic jurisprudence, wetting the lips will not nullify fasting. Also, swallowing the saliva will not nullify fasting. Moreover, tasting food will not nullify fasting, provided that nothing is swallowed. Sometimes, during eating the suhoor, that is, the meal before dawn in Ramadan, one hears the azan or call for prayer. In this case, he should take out the food in his mouth, and if he swallows it intentionally, his fasting is nullified. Putting vitamin ointment on lips to heal its cracks will not nullify fasting, provided that it doesn't mix with the saliva and is not swallowed. Using shampoos and fragrant creams is permitted in Ramadan and will not nullify fasting. Dropping medicine in the eyes will not nullify fasting. Sometimes one has heartburn and something comes out of the stomach to the throat and the mouth. In this case, the fasting person should not eat it intentionally. It was said earlier that vomiting will not nullify fasting if it is unintentional. If we look at the universe and our own creation carefully, we will understand that nothing belongs to us in the true sense of the word. As a matter of fact, we are not the owner of our life, let alone other things. Thus, we are needy and poor, and God is the rich and all-sufficient. This feature has been recommended to be observed while praying. In Ayah 15 of Surah Fatir, God says, O mankind, you are the ones who stand in need of Allah, and Allah is the all-sufficient, the all-laudable. In Dua Abu Hamza Somali, which is highly recommended to be recited in the midnights of Ramadan, this feature is quite clear. My Lord, I recognize you by you, and it is you who guided me to yourself and invited me toward yourself. And had there not been you, I would not have known you, who you are. Praise belongs to God, whom I call, and he answers me, although whenever he calls me, I delay. Praise belongs to God, who makes friend with me, although he is needless of me. And praise belongs to God, who is forbearing toward me as if I had not committed any sin. Your greatness and truthfulness of your promise caused me to come to you with my need and expose my need before you. Although I know that I'm not qualified so that my request is heard, and I do not deserve your pardoning and forgiveness to engulf me. O God, your word is true and right when you said, Ask God from his grace. Indeed, he is merciful to you. It does not behoove you, my master, to order something but avoid granting. My lord, I call you fearfully and eagerly, and hopefully and with care. My guardian, whenever I look at my sins, I become scared, and whenever I look at your nobility, I become greedy. So, if you pardon, you are the best merciful, and if you punish, you are not an oppressor. My master, I take refuge with your grace, escaping from you, your wrath, to you, your mercy. My lord, this is the position of he who has taken refuge with your nobility and is in communion with your goodness and bounties. And it is you are the generous whose pardoning will not be restricted and whose grace will not dwindle and whose mercy will not decrease.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining me and my wonderful guests on today's episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor and pleasure of having my brothers in faith and humanity join us on today's interesting discussion. To my left, I have the one and only. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh, Sister Zainab. Again, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure
thank
to be with you.
Thank you for joining us, bro.
My name is Brother Yasser. I am from South Africa.
MashaAllah.
I've been here too long. Hope to benefit.
What are you doing here? Why have you been here for so long?
I've been studying in the Islamic seminary for the last 11 years. I'm just finishing my master's.
May Allah increase your tawfiq and prolong Inshallah. Your life. And to my right, I have my special brother and guest. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us.
This is Ayman Rizvi, and I am actually in the Hawza as well for mm-hmm. about 7 to 8 years.
MashaAllah.
Finishing up my second master's program here.
We live in the age of technology, right, per se, and information and data and knowledge, sort of. Well, actually, that's debatable. Information is different from knowledge. And all of that is very much different from wisdom. That's why it's the 21st century and we still have flat earthers. I don't even know what that's about. Anyway, but we can't help but think whether it's the audience that create the news, you know, and their expectations and their eagerness and their vibe that creates the news, or is it the media that creates the trends and the news and, you know, pop culture and what people should be interested in? Which one do you guys think really has their hands on the steering wheel on this matter?
It is definitely, in my opinion,
the audience,
the media.
What?
I'll tell you why. If you watch just cartoons.
Yes.
Just cartoons.
Right?
Yes. Say it also has kids, you would probably know, like Disney cartoons, right? Not the old ones, even the new ones.
Yeah, especially the new
There was one, right, now that was recently done that talked about the human soul.
Yes.
It's called Soul.
Literally it's called Soul. Yeah.
So it was like...
And the lead character reminds me of you so much.
So my son was asking me, we watched it and my son was asking me, and then even some certain Islamic scholars, or people who are Islamically inclined, said, no, this is a good thing, you know, they're showing it. And I said, no, there are very intricate faults with this movie.
I swear to God.
I was now for me, because we speak about the soul and the ruh, it's trying to bring that down to my son was difficult. How to explain...
How old is he?
He's 12. So how to explain that concept of the soul and how this movie portrayed it in such a wrong way.
So wrong.
Right? Okay, fine, you have, but so their media now is showing you what? Is showing and showing you why one issue here, one basic issue with this movie is showing you that between a human soul and an animal soul, there is no difference.
No difference, ya Allah.
But you need someone to understand that concept in the movie to pick it up. Not everyone will pick it up,
but you
will see it. Like I told that to a friend of mine when we studied this, he said, because I studied you, so I said, whatever. So a kid watching that who doesn't have somebody who studied Islam or doesn't have that parent who has this knowledge behind him, the media showing this is what the soul is. There's no difference between you and another animal.
Exactly. Halas. And from it's going to be encrypted in their
exactly.
mind.
And from then, you have all the other philosophical theories that they bring up with.
Mm.
That you are just a machine. You can be this. You can be that.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. So not only that, if you look at fashion magazines, what are fashion magazines doing? They're creating an image of what a perfect woman is.
Yep.
So not the audience. They want the audience to follow what they are portraying. This is the shoes you wear. This is the purse you have to buy. This is the, you know, the hat you have to wear, and so on and so forth.
But to gain what objective?
Just to be fashionable.
And of course, materialism, capitalism, consumerism.
You are now judged by what you have.
Exactly. And you don't have. Exactly. So, bro, which one do you think steers it?
You know,
audience or media?
The question, I think, should be that, you know, in two perspectives, like what should be and what is currently.
Right.
Because, you know, currently media is creating news for not to cater people, not to cater the needs of the people. Media is basically is a tool right now in the hands of imperialism or, you know, the superpowers to create consumerism, as Brother Yasir has said, or some other goals, some other
objectives.
Yeah, some other objectives which are basically evil in their nature.
Mm.
So, but what should be done? It should be basically the to cater the needs of the audience. Like when I remember that I was watching a clip of a speech of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, when he came back to Iran on the same day or I think the next day, he was giving a speech in front of a huge crowd in which he mentioned that I don't have the problem with cinema. I don't have problem with the radio. I don't have problem with the television or films. I have the problem with what you show them through these mediums, right? So again, this is the.
So I don't mind the means. I mind the content.
Of course.
Okay.
The content is really important, and I really don't show cartoons anymore to my kids.
Seriously?
Yes, I don't.
You for real?
Yes, for real.
Any cartoons? Like DreamWorks, Disney, Pixar?
Not, I think, very old cartoons like Tom and Jerry or something like that. But, you know, recently I have seen all of these videos very carefully. And again, Brother Yasir is right that they are, intrinsically putting things in these animations.
I understand that, but bro, hear me out. The byproduct of Disney Channel personified, I must say.
Sure.
I'm not here to defend Disney Channel, but I'm saying that, I'm not here to defend Disney Channel at all. But it did help a lot with character building in the sense of, well, I was exposed to all of that, and then I grew up, and I was like, all right, I ain't going to want to do that. I ain't going to want to do that. I ain't want to be this. I ain't going to follow that Disney princess's footsteps because she lost her shoe at midnight, and that just doesn't make sense. Right? I was equipped with the choice to decide which course. But if you deprive your children of all that's going on in the world.
No, it's not deprivation. It's basically a selection. You know, I select things which I think are good for them. Because if you really think about it, you know, for example.
What else? But okay, if you select this for them. What is the alternative that they're exposed with?
Exactly. The alternative is basically either some Iranian cartoons, which are, you know, okay. Because you cannot show them everything. Everything on the media, you cannot show your kids.
No, you can't.
So you have to be, you need to be picky. You need to pick and choose what you can show your kids. The same way I defended homeschooling, I would defend this as well. Imam Khomeini, all of our Maraja-e-Kiram, you take a look at these personalities or all of the great Mujtahideen, they never watched Disney cartoons. They never watched anything. And they are great in their character.
They are great. Yeah, but they had alternatives.
What kind of alternatives?
Knowledge.
Of course, exactly. You need to give knowledge to your children. Yeah. You need to become the best role model possible for your kids.
Mm.
And this is exactly what I'm trying to do right now. I try not to, you know, tell them to do this or do that or don't do this or don't do that. I simply act in front of them.
Mm.
I perform them, and then kids learn themselves quickly.
Yeah, absolutely, because they're like sponges.
Yeah, they learn it quickly. And then I also do not teach anything illogical to my kids. I have my eldest son.
But, I mean, to you, it may seem logical. It might seem logical because it's your logic. But what if 15 years from now, your child looks back and you're like, yeah, what Baba said then really doesn't make sense anymore. What then?
Well, we have examples right now. I mean, I think you should ask a question from Ayatollah Khamenei that what kind of cartoons he watched when he was little. For example, in his childhood, I don't believe that there were cartoons probably, right? And cartoons or media, films, dramas, I'm not against them. Same way the Imam Khomeini said that I'm not against the
cinema.
I'm not against the I took my son to show him film Muhammad to a theater.
So, okay, the content must be
proper. The content is very important. If you don't really pay attention to the content, you will lose your generation.
Right.
You will lose your generation.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Brother Yasser, back to the other question. Do you really feel that the audience is not the one who navigates the content of what the media spits out?
Navigated or created?
Navigated, created,
they
both.
No, they can't create. It's impossible for them to create.
Why impossible? That's
because
such a strong word.
Say you mentioned something there. If you look at the media industry right now, it is governed by 4 or 5 people. That's it. And between them, they have their own
empire.
Monopoly, the empire. And between themselves, they have their own issues. They decide what they show you.
Mm.
They decide. This is not something they just. This is a huge organization.
Yeah.
They have think tanks.
Absolutely.
They have, for example, market research. It is like it's like a huge institute that planning and you know thought goes into what they are going to show.
Every step of the way.
Exactly.
Every step of
it's,
the way.
It's not something they say, oh, tomorrow, okay, fine, breaking news, whatever. That's different.
Mm-hmm.
For example, yesterday I was having a discussion with one of my teachers about the visit of the Pope to Sayyid Sistani.
Yeah.
Afodullah. Why? Why? Why did right now, what was the goal behind the Pope's visit to Iraq?
Yeah, I think about that too.
What did he go for?
Yeah, exactly.
Was there a reason for him to go to Iraq?
Yes.
Was it to see the demolished churches? Syria is worse.
Mm-hmm.
Other countries are worse. Why then decide now? Because it's a more important thing. Like even then, when Sayyid spoke to him about Palestine, for example, you know, and these type of things.
Oh, there we go, see?
See, there were things mentioned that they probably did not foresee. Because they see Sayyid as this middleman, you know, this Gandhi type of figure.
Yeah.
In fact, he isn't. You know, the wisdom that he does in all of his acts, you know, it requires a person maybe 15 years from now we will see the actual results of that wisdom. But, for example, that what I mentioned is that media, why did the speech happen with no media present? Why has he not seen any political figure for the last 10 years?
Right.
And all of these other things, you know, you can ask these questions.
So you're saying that they created this news
for a particular purpose.
Aha.
And but that purpose, according to some of the teachers and stuff that I've spoken to, it did not come to fruition.
Due to the Sayyid's wisdom.
Due to the Sayyid's wisdom.
Don't underestimate him. Don't look at his old, fragile, frail face and content.
Exactly. So also a lot of planning went into it. A lot of thought process went into it. So something so big. It's always like, for example, the newspapers, the cartoons that they're going to show you, whether Disney or not, just cartoon strips they show you, the ideas that they push in certain newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in America, you have Fox News. They're pushing, I'll put it on IRIB. Press TV itself has an agenda.
Of course.
All news agents have an agenda that they are pushing.
Absolutely.
And they have to stick to it.
Yeah.
They have to stick to that agenda.
Either it is a positive agenda or whatever a negative, the agenda may be. But they have an agenda, they have to use
otherwise
think tanks.
It's pointless,
and
it's pointless. Right?
So yeah. They want to show this agenda to who? The audience. Audience is not creating it.
Mm.
The audience, or if you're a person is wise enough, can you say, okay, this is rubbish? Or, and what is also important is like the BBC is the master in this. They will show you a news piece.
Mm.
Within that particular news piece, article, there will be 85% truth.
Mm.
Within that particular piece, there will be one or two lines that is not true, but is the agenda.
Oh.
And you will, because
of the rest of the truth, you'll accept this one too. You'll let it slide.
So they're creating it. They're showing you, they are actually putting in you what they want to show you. And I've seen this. This is actually a tactic.
That's devious.
It's a tactic in terms of propaganda.
Right.
That you will show 80%.
But then is that so wrong? Does everyone not do it? Everyone has an agenda.
That's what I'm saying. Like I mentioned, it's not an issue of having an agenda or not.
Yeah.
It is that the agenda? What is the objective of it?
I mean, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells the story of Nabi Yusuf ala nabina wa alihi alayhi salam because he wants to fit a message through that story.
Exactly. The objective of that agenda is important.
Aha.
Right?
So the means is right.
The means... The
everyone does it.
Like, when television came to Iran, even tell me when radio came to Iran.
You don't remember that, do you?
I know. I don't wasn't here at that time, but we see
you
it in
weren't
the books.
Born that time, bro.
I was not born. So when this is in the books, I must give it from my own personal experience.
Because you said it with so much conviction, yeah. I was like, what? So,
but the television, I know, because I've seen the fatwa.
Ah, okay. Right.
So when television came to Iran, marhum Allama Askari, rahmatullah alayh, says that it's haram. After a while, he said, this media or this means is a double-edged sword.
Yes.
It can be used for good.
Yes.
And it can be used for bad.
The wisdom of our scholars.
So he changed. Even the same with the radio, with Ayatollah Borujerdi, rahmatullah alayhi. Same thing.
Same with social media,
yeah,
Instagram.
Same thing. Everything. So you see that there is good in it. You can be useful. So unfortunately, we don't use it. We don't have the capacity or the infrastructure to use it as we should.
But we should, though. I mean, especially during these last few months, I feel like the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei has been emphasizing on the activities that youth should, like, you know, they should up their game regarding their activities in social media and create a platform for themselves in that atmosphere to preach the messages of their religion and to put it in, like you said, create an infrastructure for ourselves to just slip it in as subliminal messages. Don't blow it out from rooftop. Yell it out off your rooftops that, okay, Islam is the right religion and whoever does not follow it is going to burn in hell. That doesn't work. That never worked. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Thank you so very much, brothers, being with me and for our listeners. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رازقة Let us see daylight again, once again.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In February, Illinois enacted a law that rewrote many of the state's rules for policing and mandated that police officers wear body cameras. In March, New York City moved to make it easier for citizens to sue police officers. This month, the Maryland legislature, which decades ago became the first to adopt a law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, became the first state to do away with it. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Steve Eder, Michael Keller, and Blackie Migliozzi. The piece is titled, As New Police Reform Laws Sweep Across the United States, Some Ask, Are They Enough? In February, Illinois enacted a law that rewrote many of the state's rules of policing and mandated that police officers wear body cameras. In March, New York City moved to make it easier for citizens to sue police officers. This month, the Maryland legislature, which decades ago became the first state to adopt a law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, became the first state to do away with it. In recent months, state and city lawmakers across the country have seized on a push for reform prompted by outrage at the killing of George Floyd last May, passing legislation that has stripped the police of some hard-fought protections won over the past half a century. Police unions in the United States are pretty much playing defense at the moment, said Brian Marvel, a San Diego, California police officer and the president of California's largest law enforcement labor organization. He added, you have groups of people that are looking for change, and some groups are looking for radical change. Over 30 states have passed more than 140 new police oversight and reform laws, according to a New York Times analysis of data from the National Conference of State Legislatures. Amber Widgery, a police expert at the organization, said many of the laws restricting the use of force, overhauling disciplinary systems, installing more civilian oversight and requiring transparency around misconduct cases give states far more influence over policing practices that have typically been left to local jurisdictions. We're seeing the creation of really strong centralized state guidance that sets a baseline for police accountability, police behavior, and standards for all departments, she said. We'll be right back. It's a remarkable nationwide and in some places bipartisan movement that flies directly counter to years of deference to the police and their powerful unions. But the laws and new rules adopted by police departments across the country are not enough to satisfy demands by Black Lives Matter and other activists who are pushing for wholesale reforms, cultural shifts, and cutbacks at law enforcement agencies. The focus has been so heavily on what do we do after harm has already been committed, after the police have already engaged in misconduct, and far less focused on how do we stop this from the beginning, said Paige Fernandez, an advocate at the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. While Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer accused of murdering George Floyd, was on trial last week, episodes in Virginia, Minnesota, and Illinois, which have all enacted reforms, underscored how the new laws would not always prevent traumatic outcomes. A police officer in Virginia was seen on video pointing a gun at a Black Army lieutenant and pepper spraying him during a traffic stop. A veteran police officer in Minnesota fatally shot a 20-year-old, Daunte Wright, a Black man, after pulling him over. And video recordings showed a Chicago police officer chasing and fatally firing at a 13-year-old teenager, Adam Toledo, a Latino, after he appeared to toss aside a gun whilst obeying commands to raise his hands. The events ignited fresh protests and more questions about why police officers and police interventions escalated into deaths of people of color. People aren't necessarily happy with the change they're seeing, because the same thing keeps happening again and again, said Savanta Clark, whose brother, Stephen, was killed by the Sacramento police in 2018. California enacted a law named after his brother that raised the standard for using lethal force. But Savanta Clark sees a need for the federal government to impose national regulations. House Democrats recently passed a sweeping police bill designed to address racial discrimination and excessive use of force by police officers, but it lacks the Republican support needed in the Senate. President Joe Biden has also fallen short of a campaign promise to establish an oversight commission during his first 100 days in office. Nearly 1,000 people have been shot and killed by police officers annually in recent years, according to data from the Washington Post, which also shows that police officers fatally shot Black and Hispanic people at a much higher rate by population than whites. Some activists have cheered new laws that could curb police misconduct, mainly in states and cities controlled by Democrats. But they also fear that those changes could be offset in Republican jurisdictions that are proposing to expand police protections or impose harsher penalties for protest-related activities like blocking highways and defacing public property. Police unions, along with many Republican lawmakers, have resisted some of the reform efforts, arguing that they will imperil public safety. But there have been some signs of bipartisanship. In Colorado, for example, Republicans joined with Democrats, who controlled the state house, to pass a sweeping bill less than a month after George Floyd's death. The law banned chokeholds, required police officers to intervene if they witnessed excessive force, and mandated body cameras statewide within 3 years, among other provisions. The Colorado legislature became the first to eliminate immunity from civil rights accusations, allowing police officers to face claims in state courts. John Cook, a Republican state senator and former Colorado County Sheriff, worked with Democrats to revise their proposals. Officials, he said, realized that we need to do something, and we need to do it now. Republican-led states, including Iowa and Utah, have implemented changes too, banning or restricting chokeholds, among other measures. But Iowa's Republican-controlled House recently passed a Back to Blue bill that black lawmakers said could unfairly affect peaceful protesters and amounted to retaliation against Democrats. In Maryland, the democratically controlled legislature overrode a veto by the state's Republican governor to pass a sweeping reform package. Outlining his objections, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said the laws would be damaging to police recruitment and police retention, posing significant risks to public safety. Importantly, the package erases the Law Enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights in the state, a landmark achievement for police unions in the 1970s. Decades ago, similar protections spread across the country in union contracts and local laws, but its passage in Maryland gave broad protections to every department at once. Critics said the policing Bill of Rights reduced accountability. Police officers could wait days before being questioned about an allegation. Only fellow police officers could conduct interrogations. Some complaints could be expunged from an officer's file after a few years. It is fitting that Maryland is the first state to repeal it, as they opened this Pandora's box in the first place, said Kaylin Young, public policy director at the American Civil Liberties Union of Maryland. Maryland's new laws contain a range of provisions to rein in policing, a body camera requirement for police officers regularly interacting with the public, prison sentences up to 10 years for violations of the state's use of force policy, and restrictions on so-called no-knock warrants. Those warrants drew national attention last year when the police in Louisville, Kentucky fatally shot Breonna Taylor, an unarmed emergency medical technician, after smashing through her apartment door during a botched drug raid. Louisville banned the warrants last summer, and state lawmakers limited their use this month. Another Maryland law, named after Anton Black, requires disclosure of information about police misconduct investigations. The 19-year-old Anton Black died in 2018 after police officers pinned him to the ground following a struggle. Prosecutors did not pursue charges in this case, but his family has sued in federal court. LaToya Hawley, Anton Black's sister, said that the new laws would help, but that a broader shift in policing was needed. That culture and that mentality has to do a complete 180-degree turn if we want to enact changes, she said. And it has to start in-house with the police departments, the police captains and chiefs, and also the boards that are actually certifying these police officers. Maryland's new standards follow a decision by Baltimore State's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, to stop prosecuting minor crimes like prostitution and drug possession. When we criminalize these minor offenses that have nothing to do with public safety, we expose people to needless interaction with law enforcement that, for black people in this country, can often lead to a death sentence, Ms. Mosby told the Baltimore City Council last week.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.